Thank you guys for joining my talk. I'm going to be focusing on mainly food contact materials and the regulations surrounding those throughout the world. Just a quick intro. My name is Dennis Ashford. I have a PhD in chemistry, so I am a chemist. I'm not the regulatory expert on our team. I work with them. They're pretty awesome. They're great at what they do. But I worked in the chemical industry for several years, and then I was actually a professor of chemistry before moving over to Intertech Assurus. So the title of this talk is Next Generation Food Contact Materials and Getting Their Clearance from the Regulators. And again, this kind of, I'm gonna focus on the US FDA, but the concepts in here really apply to worldwide regulators. Slight differences depending on where you are in the world, but for the most part, the ideas are the same. So just quickly, kind of the outline. First, I'm going to give you a brief intro into Intertech and specifically Intertech Assurus. Some of you in here may have worked with Intertech in the past. It's a huge company. It's mainly known for testing, but we also have regulatory expertise. That's where we sit. Just a brief intro into global food contact regulations, the three major ones, US and the EU and China, we'll focus on there. And then the rest of it is really going to focus on the US FDA FCN process. So again, we'll focus on that because that's where we sit, but the ideas overall apply to the EU and China and throughout the rest of the world. And then at the very end, just kind of touching on if you're working on really novel materials in the space, how we approach those projects from the FCN side. So just who we are. So Intertech Assurus is a worldwide organization. So again, Intertech is worldwide. It's almost 50,000 employees. So it's a very large company. Assurus specifically focuses on regulations, and that can be anything from food contact to cosmetics, pharmaceuticals. So we really focus on a lot of different things. And you can see we have people all over the world. And in these specific regions, we have experts that focus on the regulations in those areas. So again, I am based in the US, so I mainly focus on the US side, but we have our colleagues here in Europe that focus on the EU. We have a lot of colleagues in Asia, in China and Japan specifically, some in Australia, and we have not really broken into South America yet, but that is on the plan. Hopefully I get to go visit when we do that, so that'd be awesome. But so again, we have people all over the world, and we kind of like to think of ourselves as a turnkey service. So we have all of the expertise that's required for these submissions. So we have the analytical expertise, which is kind of where I sit. So I'm mainly an analytical chemist. We have the regulatory experts that help put together these dossiers for the submission. We have our toxicologists that, you know, do the safety assessment of these materials. And then again, just kind of looking back at that map, we have people all over the world that know the specific regulations in those areas. So we can kind of take a material and really do everything that would be required to get the approved regulations for those. So again, we like to think of it as a turnkey, but we also really enjoy working with our clients on these projects because they are challenging depending on what we're working with. So just kind of intro into food contact regulations. So we could spend hours on this. If you've ever dived into these regulations, you know they can be quite complex. The nice thing about the regulations is, in general, the ideas are the same. It's mainly centered around human safety and the consumer safety. All right. The approach to get to that may be slightly different, but the idea being the same of we need to protect the consumer. And so there's usually a regulatory framework. So again, mainly focus on no danger to human health. If you've ever looked at, say, the US FDA regulations, the 21 CFR is kind of the base of that. And then you get into the different chapters of that. The EU has 10/2011 for polymers. So it just depends on where you're working at. Then you start to look for the materials. So your material may already be cleared, and you just need to ensure that you are falling under that clearance. So we have an entire team that looks for compliance of materials that may already be regulated. But again, overall, you kind of look into the documents, see if you fall under that. That sounds easier than it actually is because they can be confusing. And then obviously GMP. So if you're gonna manufacture materials that are going into consumer products, specifically food that can go into your diet, you have to ensure that you maintain GMP. And there's ways you can do that, either depending on your manufacturing process or audits, depending on the regulation and where you are, how you do that. So just real quick before I dive into the three major markets, just two definitions that often get confused. A food additive is generally considered something that would reasonably be assumed to go into the diet of the consumer and modify the food somehow, okay? Ingredients obviously are a food additive, but something in the packaging that may go in at a significant amount could be deemed a food additive, and that's a totally different set of regulations than what we're gonna mainly focus on, or I'm gonna focus on. A food contact substance, which is what this talk mainly focuses on, is something that's usually in the packaging that is not intended to modify the food in any way. So I've mentioned the word packaging here because that's typically what people think about when they think about food packaging and food contact materials. But it turns out that anything that manufactures food as well generally also needs to be cleared. So I know there's a lot of manufacturers of sealants in here, or seals. We actually do a lot of FCNs on those as well. So it's not directly food packaging, but it goes into the manufacturing of the food, and those also need to be cleared. So we've worked with several companies on O-rings and stuff like that for food contact. So again, we're gonna focus on the food contact. Then the three major ones, again, this talk's mainly gonna focus on the US FDA, but frameworks are similar. If you've ever looked in the 21 CFR from the FDA, it gets quite complicated, quite fast. Again, we have a whole team of experts that know this thing in and out. It always amazes me. They can just spit out the chapter that you need to go to for a specific polyethylene or something. It's quite impressive. But depending on what the material is, depending on what the application is, your material may already be cleared by one of these. Again, they're specific either compositions or impurity profiles or whatever that you may need to meet, but it may be in there. But a lot of people in here are working on new materials that may not fall under the 21 CFR regulations, and that's where the FCN, or the Food Contact Notification Program, comes into play. So that's when you are developing novel polymers, novel additives, whatever, that's when an FCN submission is typically needed. So that's what we typically focus on in our group. Just real quick, the EU regulations, it looks simpler. It is a little bit, but not a whole lot simpler than the FDA. The idea is the same. The EU does tend to regulate more on the monomer side than the polymer side, where the FDA focuses on the final polymer more so than the monomer. If you're working with plastics, the EU 10/2011 is the major regulation there, and it's updated often. So if you do go to the 10/2011 regulation to say look for your material, make sure you're looking at the latest version. They update that thing on a monthly basis, and it's really easy to look at older versions and kind of get tricked by that. So always make sure you're looking at the newest one for that, for the EU 10/2011. And then just finally, China. China looks the most complex. They just break it down a bit more than the other two. Generally with China, we like to think of it as a hybrid between the EU and the US regulations. And with China, you typically have to have two cleared regulatory materials already. And by that, I mean, a lot of times clients will get a US clearance, a EU clearance, and then go to China. Okay, it just makes the application a lot easier. So that's usually the way it works. It can be different, but again, we have experts that know this one. I do not know the China regulations hardly at all. So please don't ask me questions on that. But you can send me an email and I can get someone to help with that. So that's just kind of a quick intro to those, to the regulations. What I'm gonna focus on is food contact notification submissions and kind of how these things work, all right? A lot of people, I've talked to several people at this conference, and it's like, oh, that's a big project. I don't even know how to approach that. So my goal is to just give you a high level overview of what we do in these submissions. Okay, and so the first thing I want to say is if your material is not listed in the regulations, which is usually true for something that's novel, right, that you're working on, or if it doesn't meet the requirements. And so the requirements could be percent composition, it could be extractables. There's a variety of requirements that go into those. That's when these petitions are typically needed. Sometimes it may be an FCN, sometimes it may be something else, but if it doesn't meet those specific requirements, that's where these petitions come in. Okay. So if we think about food packaging, again, this applies also to food manufacturing, but it's easiest to think about packaging. You have a nice, looks like a ribeye sitting in there. You have some usually piece of plastic around that, all right? Well, it turns out that the plastic does have materials that can go into that food, and it eventually ends up in your diet and eventually ends up inside of you. And so these regulators, when they think about the safety of these materials, you have to think about everything that could migrate into the food, all right? And I use the word could there because when we go through this process, we have to think about what is everything you put into the manufacturing pot, all right? That's everything that could. What are the decomposition products? What are the byproducts? And what are some of the leftover, say, residual monomers or other things, all right? And we have to sit there and review those and think about what is the best way to test those? Do we have to worry about them? Do they have concerning tox profiles? And that's kind of the very first thing we do is a mental exercise of what could migrate, all right? Then we have to review those. So that's where the toxicologists come in. If we look at materials and, you know, they are not a concern from a tox profile, generally we don't have to worry about those, but sometimes we run into things that do have a concerning tox profile, like say, for example, isocyanates are great for polymers, terrible for your body. So you just have to be very wary of them in the material itself, okay? So for the FDA, again, I'm going to focus on the FDA, but it's true for the EU as well. The FDA takes a tiered approach to these FCN submissions and the materials that we're looking for. And it's pretty simple. Basically, the more exposure the consumer is to these materials, the more data that's required for that specific analyte that we're looking at. All right. And so I know I've talked to a couple of people at this conference. They mentioned TOR exemptions. So that is a threshold of regulations. In US FDA, that is a dietary concentration of less than 0.5 ppb. So in the EU, some of you may have heard of NIAZ, non-intentionally added substances. There's a big new regulation that just came out. They want you to measure down to 0.5 ppb. And if anyone in here is an analytical chemist knows that is very challenging to do, almost unfair. But these are over here, I wish I had a laser pointer. These are not concentrations in the material, they are dietary concentrations. So depending on the application, depending on the material this is gonna go into, there's a set of calculations we have to do to get those exposures. But if you're below 0.5 ppb, generally, you're okay from the dietary concentration, and we don't have to do a lot of tox review on that. Most of our clients that we work with in the FCN space fall into tox tier or two or three. That is where you're, again, above this 0.5 ppb up to about 50 ppb. If you're in that range, the tox tier you generally can do what's called cross-reading in the toxicology profile. So there's a lot of tox studies. You may not have a tox study on your specific material, but you can kind of look at the structure, compare that structure to something that's been done before, and you can say if that is of concern or not. If you fall into tox tier three, that's where you need a bit more data to back it up. A lot of times that data is available, so you or we don't have to generate it because you may know tox studies are quite expensive. But sometimes we do have to end up generating that data. So that could be genotox studies or something else. And if you're above 1 ppm in the dietary concentration, that's where you get into the food additive side. So that's a totally different set of submissions. And typically, if our clients have migration and exposure greater than 1 parts per million, there's other things we can do to not have to go down the food additive petition, like take a market volume limitation or something. So a lot of times we work with our clients to see what is the best approach to do this, where we don't have to do a ton of analytical and tox studies. Okay. So to build an FCN, there's 3 major components that go into it. The first thing is obviously the chemical information. So the identity and the composition of the FCS, so that's the food contact substance, its properties and specifications, the manufacturing process, and impurities and breakdown products. A lot of times this data is coming from the clients to us. They tell us we already know what the impurities are in that material. So we can take those impurity profiles and do some tox assessment on that. All right. Then the conditions of use. So how much are we going to use? Is it a polymer film that it's 100% going to be the packaging, or is it an additive, or is it used in manufacturing? So those things vary. Is it single use or repeat use? And then what are the conditions of use? Is this going to go into a microwave susceptible that goes, you know, really high temperature, really fast, or is it just for freezer packaging meat, right? Those are very different applications, and that's something else we need to. And then obviously food type. Is it aqueous? Is it alcoholic? Is it fatty? All those things matter in these submissions. And then finally, this is where we kind of sit in our expertise, is looking at migration and exposure to the consumer of these materials. So the level of migration we determine either by calculations or migration studies. Then we can estimate the dietary exposure, and then finally do the tox assessment. So again, we have all of this in-house, and we all work together on a daily basis. Okay. So thinking about these breakdown products, because this is where most of the time and energy gets spent in these FCN submissions. And so regulatory authorities are mostly concerned with materials that are below 1,000 Daltons. And the reason is twofold. The first is those are the ones that are likely to migrate out of the film, so they can move just physically in the film easier. They can get to the food and migrate out. And number two, anything that's less than 1,000 Daltons typically is more bioavailable, which means it can pass through the cell wall and cause things to happen that we don't want to happen inside of our bodies. So those are the two materials, or those are the materials we tend to focus on. And when we look at these, we have to include things that are expected. So, you know, in a polymer, that may be residual monomers and catalysts, but also unexpected materials. So what are decomposition products that we may get from these materials. Okay, so then what are the analytical approaches? So this is where I sit. So I first want to start off by saying these submissions are, we like to call them a journey. So we kind of start off, we don't really know what the strategy is. We sit down, we talk about it with the client, and then we kind of bring in all of the experts in the room and think about what is the most efficient way to get regulatory compliance. So within Intertech, we have the polymer chemistry expertise, the regulatory, analytical, and the tox expertise, but we also ensure that we utilize the client's expertise, okay? Because we are not developing these materials. You guys are developing the new materials. So you know these materials better than we do, and so we really utilize your expertise when we really sit down and design the strategy to get compliance for these, all right? And so the first thing we have to do is characterize these, all right? So I'm going to stick with polymers because that's kind of the easiest example. But when we think about polymer characterization, the first thing we need to know is what's the molecular weight profile, all right? So we need to know molecular weight profile, but as I mentioned before, we need to know what is the percent less than 1,000 Daltons of the low molecular weight oligomers. That's LMWO. You'll see that acronym a lot if you go through this FCN process. So low molecular weight oligomers, how much, what's the concentration of that in these materials? The next thing is what are the impurities? Okay, again, impurities may be expected, monomers, catalyst, different solvents, but also what are some of the things that we do not expect, decomposition products. And so we have a lot of expertise in taking a polymer from our clients, fully dissolving it, and then running a bunch of chromatography to figure out what are all the different materials in here. The other thing we've done a lot is catalyst. So, you know, you may develop a catalyst that turns over rapidly in your system, but once you quench the reaction, you really don't know what the decomposition products are. So we have ways of mimicking that manufacturing process in the laboratory that we can then kind of identify and characterize these decomposition products. From those values of the impurities, we can do worst case dietary exposure calculations and determine really what are the things of concern. And that's when we finally go to migration testing. And migration testing, again, is looking at things leaching out of the film. The thing I want to say on this slide is generally our goal is not to have to do migration testing. And the reason is migration testing takes a long time and it's quite expensive. Okay, so our goal, if we don't have to, we want to clear the material just looking at the residuals or maybe even the manufacturing process. In that case, generally you're already cleared if you're looking at the regulations. But for the most part, if we can clear the tox profiles without the migration study, we like to do that just because it saves everyone time and money. But sometimes we do just have to do migration testing. Generally, that's looking for the low molecular weight oligomers, sometimes residual monomers, and then again, anything that may have concerning tox profiles. I mentioned before, isocyanates is an example there. Okay, so real quick, if you've never seen a migration study, the idea is pretty simple. The implication is fairly complex. You basically take a plaque of your film, you put it in a food simulant. So it could be an aqueous simulant, could be a fatty food simulant, could be alcoholic. You, depending on the conditions of use, again, is this high temperature, low temperature? What's the time frame? You put it in the simulant, you stick it in an oven for so many days, you take out an aliquot of the simulant at these specific time periods, and you inject it into, say, a GCMS and look for that, all right? Again, the theory sounds easy, the implication is quite challenging, but that's what we're doing. We're just looking for these things coming off the film over time as we're aging them at different temperatures, all right? And then, again, you analyze those solutions for the migrants, okay? So, again, going back to the strategy, these regulators are concerned about safety. They don't care, sounds terrible, but they don't really care about your chemistry. They don't care how cool your thing is. They don't care how important it is. If it's a concern to the consumer, they will not clear it. So we're always thinking about what is the safety of this? And the way we do that is looking at these dietary concentrations and then working with our toxicologists from those exposures. Okay. So again, going back to that stepped analytical process, at each step, our goal is to remove things of concern as we go through the process, because the more we can remove, the less analytical we have to do at the end before we submit this. So we can take the manufacturing process. You guys know what you put into your pot, what the amounts are, okay? We can take those values and see what the exposure is to the consumer. Then we can do residuals analysis. We can take those values and see what the exposure is to the consumer. And then finally, if we have to, we do the migration study to refine those or lower those exposure values. And then at each step, we do a tox assessment of those and kind of check things off the list and kind of windle that down to what we have to do if we have to go to a migration study. Okay, so it's a stepwise process that we work closely with the client in these, because again, I mentioned before, it's a journey. These things do take time, but there's a lot of advantages to having approval, as some of you probably know if you have an FCN, an active FCN. So this is just a graphic showing that. So again, starting with the manufacturing process, then moving into the residuals analysis, migration testing if we need it, and then finally submission. And I put the champagne bottles on there because when you submit one of these packages, these dossiers, hundreds of pages, lots of work, lots of collaboration between everyone involved, and it's a really good feeling to submit those. With the FDA specifically, they typically have a 4 to 8 week, what they call completeness check. And so what they'll do is they review the package and they ensure that you kind of have everything that you need for the application for that. Then after that, they have a 120-day review period where they actually kind of dive in and make sure all the data makes sense. I will say if you pass the completeness check, you typically pass the second part. So most of the time, that first completeness check is where we are kind of holding our breath and seeing if we're going to have a good FCN or not. Okay, so two more things. First one is I mentioned the LMWOs, these low molecular weight oligomers. If anyone in here is a polymer chemist, you have worked with these at some point and you know they're terrible to work with. They're a pain, all right? And they're even more of a pain when we think about the FDA or regulators, because again, they're worried about these because they're less than 1,000 Daltons, all right? So low molecular weight oligomers are challenging. And the reason they're challenging is, they're already concerned with that. But the reason they're challenging is they're a polymer, but they're kind of a small molecule at the same time. So first off, they have different lengths. They have different structures. They could be linear or branched depending on the polymerization process, different physical and chemical properties. But the biggest problem is when you're thinking about quantifying these is you do not have a reference that you can use for these. If it's a, especially if it's a new polymer or a new material you're working with, you can't just call up Fisher and get a standard for that, okay? And so when you're thinking about quantifying these, if you think about an external calibration curve, we don't have standards for these, all right? And so at Intertech, some of my colleagues, and this is like the coolest thing I think we do, we have a lot of expertise in LMWO characterization and quantification, okay? And the reason is because this stuff is hard and we've spent a lot of time thinking about it. And so what we're able to do is we are able to actually pull out a LMWO reference material from the polymer itself. So it's literally kind of the perfect reference. We do a full characterization of that LMWO reference. I said it before, I'm a chemist, so anytime I see a good NMR, I'm going to put it up there. So we can do NMR, GCMS, IR, kind of depending on what we're working with. And then we can use that as the reference material when we do these migration studies or residual analysis. And so I will say, if you ever submit one of these applications, again, I know the FDA the best, they will scrutinize what you use for the reference. So if you are submitting a polyimide and you use polystyrene as your reference, they're gonna not accept it. I'm just telling you right now, because polystyrene and polyimides are very different, all right? So you have to make sure that you have the right reference. And what's great is since we developed this technique, I didn't develop this, someone else did, at one of our labs, we've never had a question on this from the FDA. So that's great. We've had other questions, we're not perfect, but it's been really awesome to see that since we've developed this technique, which they've done over the past 2 to 3 years, we've never had a question on our LMWO quantification and characterization since then. So this is just showing a nice calibration curve. This is using one of these references that we have pulled out of one of these polymers that we submitted for an FCN. And so now when we do migration studies, we can clearly quantify how much of these low molecular weight oligomers are migrating out of the films, okay? And just real quick, one last thing. If you do submit an FCN and you're working with an external lab, if you're not working with Intertech, make sure they validate the technique, all right? We tend to think about, at least myself as an analytical chemist, if I have a straight calibration curve, I think that means the method's valid. It does not mean it's valid, at least by the FDA standards. You have to do spiking and recovery experiments, okay? Even the FDA says this is the most common reason they deny applications. So ensure that your lab or whoever you're working with is doing the proper spiking and recovery and they get the values that the FDA requires for that. All right. So this is pretty simple for residuals. So monomers, let's say a monomer, you can go purchase a reference. Again, you can add the reference, make sure you get that reference back in the experiment. But going back to those low molecular weight oligomers, that's challenging. So again, if you're working with a polyimide and you add in polystyrene, that's not a one-to-one. Spiking and recovery doesn't work, and the FDA is gonna question you on that. So again, I'm gonna toot our own horn. We can do this with our LMWO references that we generate, and again, that's gonna minimize those questions from the regulators. And so finally, just kind of talking about next generation. So a lot of people in here work in innovation. I used to work in innovation before I moved over to Intertech. And the regulators are always open to new and novel materials. So you can see on there, carbon nanotube. There's a lot of cool things going into packaging and processing of food materials. And this is kind of where I love this job. If you're working with something like a polyolefin that's, you know, I'll say quote unquote pretty standard, the hurdles you may have to kind of jump to get clearance may be a little bit lower, and the reason is the tox state is usually available. All right, so polyolefins, a lot of tox studies on, so you can do kind of those cross-referencing. However, if you're working with something new, say nanoparticles, the tox data may not be available, so we may need to either think about generating it or using a different strategy to demonstrate there's no migration or something in that process. But so it does make some of the analytical hurdles maybe a bit more challenging. But some of you may know this if you're working in this space. If you're the first to get an FCN on a new material, that could be really big. Because the thing about FCNs is they are manufacturer specific. That's yours. No one else has that access to the clearance because you are the manufacturer, you got the FCN, and they do not. So you're kind of ahead of the game in that case. Not quite a patent, which is 10 years, but they still have to go through all the work that you just did to get that. All right. And so at Intertech, we are working with a wide variety of clients. So we're working with everything from startups to very large corporations on new novel materials. So obviously biopolymers and stuff like that are gaining a lot of traction. Just one word of caution, just because it comes from nature does not mean it's safe. We get that a lot, like, oh, it comes from a plant, so it's safe. That's not true. Plants have a lot of nasty stuff in them as well. So just a word of caution there. But biopolymers, biodegradable polymers and stuff like that, we're working on. And then again, our goal is to just kind of give a clear path of clearance. What's the best approach here? Hopefully we don't have to do a ton of analytical because that is expensive. We may have to, but again, there's advantages to doing that. We think our analytical labs are the best as well. So we're a little biased in that. And then go back to that point, collaboration. These are journeys, they're big projects. They take a lot of information back and forth. And so we really appreciate the collaboration between them. And just finally, I do wanna say, we are all innovators. Even though I now work in regulation, in the regulation space, I was an innovator at one time. This is the last professional headshot I had, so that's why I used it. I used to be a professor of chemistry, and so I know what the innovation cycle looks like. If you are working on something that may need regulatory clearance, please get those regulatory experts involved as quick as possible. The absolute worst thing you can do is spend 2 years in a laboratory developing something for food contact, and then you come to a regulatory expert and there is something in there that is horribly carcinogenic and it just kills it. Okay, so please get them involved quickly. But we love the innovation process because it's fun and exciting for us. We get to think with you as you're innovating these materials and kind of thinking about how do we get clearance later on. All right, and we're invested in these projects as well. These projects are a lot of fun. They present their own challenges. We love a good challenge. And so our objective is to provide honest and open feedback. We, compared to some of our competitors, we tend to give, this is gonna be the total cost of the full project, not just a per hour basis, that's a black box. So we think that that's kind of nice. So then you can budget that upfront. Okay, so just conclusion. So Intertech, a lot of people know us as a testing company because we do a lot of testing, but we also have the regulatory expertise in-house, so we have all of the regulations, the tox experts, the analytical chemists in-house to make us kind of a turnkey service. Again, going back to the LMWOs, we've developed a novel technique for that, and it's been really, really successful for us. And then, yeah, we love working with large and small corporations. We have really good relationships with some of the world's largest chemical companies, and then we have some really cool collaborations happening with startups as well. And we have regulatory experts all over the world. Again, I'm based in the US, but we have people in the EU, China, and Asia as well. And that is it. Thank you for your time.